Welcome to the Lob Podcast, brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off Manscaped products when you use code TFT20.
Welcome to the Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield. I'm delighted to say we are once again back in the centre circle where we are going, where we can welcome a very special guest to discuss what for me is an incredible book. And it's certainly an incredibly interesting book and opened up a completely new concept to me that I wasn't aware of. Not, I profess to know everything about everything, but what we're going to talk about tonight is certainly something that was really, really new to me, but something that I am very passionate about in terms of football and its place in society. But before we come to that, obviously, I would like to introduce the two regular co-hosts. So I think we'll start with Mr. Gary Thacker tonight. Gary, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, buddy. Nice to be on talking about a football book again, which, as you mentioned, is a fascinating read about one of these clubs that, you know, to use the phrase, it's out there. It's out there. And it's probably a club that a lot of people have heard about and know a little bit about, but don't know a lot about and should know a lot more about and therefore should read this book. And I'm sure after we have this podcast, there'll be a lot of people looking to buy this book and read it.
I absolutely agree. Like I say, it's something that is one of those things that I thought I knew, but actually when it came to it, I actually really didn't. I actually didn't know, not even 5% of what there is to know about this club.
Yeah, I come across it a while ago. When I say a while ago, I mean perhaps 18 months, 2 years ago. And I didn't know much about it then. I knew a little bit more than I did know. But it's a fascinating read, and it's, as I say, it's a club that most people have heard about and need to know a lot more about. And this book's the way to do that.
I absolutely would agree with that. Second up, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, welcome.
How are we doing, Stu?
Very well, thank you. Yourself?
Yes, very, very good. I'm looking forward to this one. Now, as Gary said, a fascinating football club at the heart of this book. And one of those clubs where you it just leaves you feeling you wish there was a British version of them, but there isn't.
Actually, do you know that's exactly it? When I'd finished, I was trying to not decide, you know, which club comes close, because there isn't, but which club has the potential to maybe to move closer towards is probably the best I could get.
Yeah, you're always looking for some kind of parallel, aren't you? And you know, something that helps. Not a mysterious topic, but you know, a topic that has a certain amount of shade to it that is detached from your own nation, and try to bring some kind of parallel to it. You know, we always do it with kind of like the biggest clubs and the giants that have fallen by the wayside a little bit, and you can always draw certain parallels between certain clubs, and including a very large club from the same city that this club inhabits. You know, there's a big club there that is easily to draw parallels to certain English football clubs, but the club in question, nope.
It is, absolutely. I absolutely agree. And I think, let's hear from the author first of all. So our special guest, now you're going to have to excuse my East Yorkshire accent, shall we say, and I will channel my more continental accent. However, our special guest is Nacho Parra. He's a Labour lawyer working to defend only the workers and trade unions, part of a cooperative based on the principles of direct democracy, social economy, defence of minorities, defence of Catalan culture and language. Academic background in regards to the context of university, has concentrated on investigating trade unions, social movements and radicalisation in jihadism. Now, the book that we're going to talk about is Sampoli, Another Football is Possible. with an intro like that, Nacho, welcome. We are so, so delighted to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here with you.
So first of all, the book, like I say, you know, Stephen and Gary, you know, both sort of chatted about, you know, how important the book is, I guess, how important the club is. But for us, or certainly for the people who are listening, a little bit about what the book is about, and a little bit about why you decided to write it. Because it is actually a co-authored book, isn't it?
Well, in fact, the book is about Sampdoria. Sampdoria, as you know, is a football club in Hamburg in Germany. And it's quite interesting or quite important because of the its links with politics. So we try to explain the history of São Paulo, explaining the history of the city and focusing on how the politics or how the club was involved in each moment. So I think that the book, as well as the club, is some football, some about football, some about politics or activism, and this is how the idea the book came about. I mean, I think that we have to go back to 2010. When a group of people from Barcelona decided to found a São Paulo fan club, we all had two features or two characteristic elements. We were activists in different fields, I mean, in trade unions or social movements or far left political parties, and we really like football. So we follow some clubs linked with politics and the left wing scene, as Livorno or Celtic Glasgow. And finally, we decided to found that fan club. From that day, obviously, we started following the club. And some years later, four of us had the idea to write about a book about the history of São Paulo. Two of them left the projects, and only Carlos and me stayed. From the beginning, the idea was just to write a book for us. I mean, for the fan club, just to know more about São Paulo. And the intention was to self-publish the book. But in the process of creation, we realized that perhaps more people would be interested in São Paulo, because on that day, São Paulo was followed by many people as an anti-fascist club. And so we thought that perhaps people who has a concrete idea of football and clubs, they are following São Paulo because of that idea, connection with a club that respond to their political idea. So that's the idea, and that's the explanation of how the book came about and the process of the creation of that history.
That's wonderful. You know, hopefully that's all, you know, people who are listening, hopefully that's already sort of whetted your appetite for the next sort of 45 minutes to an hour or so. And as Gary said about buying the book, Gary, you know, I'll come to you first. You know, you've done, or we've done together, but certainly through your idea, four or five series of political football podcasts. This must be right in your sweet spot.
Yeah, I guess, you know, when as soon as I read the book, and I said I knew a little bit about the club before, but not that much. You was thinking, you know, I think this is probably the obvious club to do a political football podcast on. You know, I mean, it couldn't be much more political if you tried. As you say, it's right in the sweet spot for me. It's about football. It's about politics. It's about society. It's about the relationship between the football club and the place and the people of the area. And you know, it sort of, it doesn't only describe the football, it describes the society. And I don't mean, when I say the society, I don't just mean the people, I mean the society as a group. Because there seems to be almost like a group closure. I mean, that sounds stupid, because the thing that everybody's welcome there, but you have to sort of have a certain attitude, a certain belief, a certain type of ethics to be a fan of São Paulo. And as Nacho said, it's very much an anti-fascist club. It's very much a left-wing club. And, I would say more power to them for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Stephen, I suppose, you touched on at the intro where you look for sort of parallels, and there's been sort of socialist elements, should we say, in certain clubs, whether it's through its geographical location or whether it's through a manager or a particular figurehead. But there's never been anything, like you said, with this sort of magnitude and this sort of consistency in the English game.
No, there isn't any club in the English game that can mirror this. I like to think, as Liverpool supporter, we have a certain anti-establishment stance. It is very much a left-leaning city. But there are dissidents who will always shout down, or not shout down, but will always protest that football shouldn't be politicised or used as a political vehicle to for other means. But no, there isn't, I think, a club in English football that can match mirror what St. Pauli do and what they represent. I find St. Pauli to be an incredible club, and there's a few dotted around Europe who tick the same box in so many ways. You can look at Livorno in Italy, Union Berlin in Germany again, Rayo Vallecano. They are clubs that have a certain activism about them, a will to change the way that people think, the way that people approach the sport, and not just the sport but life in general, and the fact that you can change the landscape via the collective. I think that's what these issues come to. A club like St. Pauli, I know that it's an amazing thing how they went from twice near bankruptcy to the club that they are now, and what they represent, not just in Hamburg and to the wider German game, but to have made an imprint that they are a recognisable force for good, for football watchers across the spectrum of the game, and from many other nations. You only have to look at the fact that they have a purported 10 to 11 million followers around the world, and they're an incredible football club that has no mirror image within the English game.
Nacho will listen to what Stephen said there, but if we go back to the sort of very beginnings and the formation of the club, and Stephen mentioned Hamburg there, and a little bit about, I suppose, the district of St. Pauli and how this club sort of came to be in the very early days.
Well, I think that St. Pauli founders and the whole area had changed through the years. At the beginning of the 20th century, when the club was found, for example, We could find two different areas. One of them was near Hafenstrasse, that later on it became one of the center of the autonomous movement or the squatter movement. But at that time in Hafenstrasse, the bourgeois, people who own means of production, live. And that people in a good position in terms of economic issue used to live in a big house situated in that area. But on the other hand, we could find workers, people who had job related with the port, obviously dockers and this kind of job. We cannot forget that the port of Hamburg is located in St. Pauli and is one of the most important ports around Europe. And this reality came when some migrant people arrived at St. Pauli to work in that jobs related to the port. So there was an important concentration of working people that transformed, that changed the features of that area. And related to the club, I think that there are some aspects to consider it. But first of all, football is an English sport. So it was practiced by English people or by people who went to England or Britain. So for that reason, at that days, I'm talking at the beginning of the 20th century or the late of the century before, football was not a popular sport. In fact, St. Pauli was found by a group of local burghers, and St. Pauli was a bourgeois football club, as the whole football clubs in that moment. For example, the club was founded at St. Pauli Tanverein, and specifically it was oriented to promote liberalism and an important nationalist feeling. So I think that statements are in the beginning are in the foundation of the club. So the changes became later. I mean, many decades after the foundation, because at that time the club was another football club, as well as the other football clubs that are in not only in that area, not only in Hamburg, not only in Germany, but also all around Europe.
I was just going to come to you then, Gary, and I suppose there's no indication, or there's certainly no inclination. You know, I was reading the book. There's no real inclination as to what's to come in the very early stage of this formation of this club. As you know, as Nacho's just said there, the formation was very much sort of a very traditional route in terms of the formation of a sporting club, and there was no real sort of indicators as to what was actually going to happen and the impact that they were going to have.
No, yeah, absolutely right. And, you know, I guess it's quite possible that if there had been an indicator as to how the club's going to turn out, it may not have been, launched successfully, shall we say. It perhaps the sort of original ordinariness of its sort of perception was the thing that allowed it to sort of get established and grow and allowed it then to transform into a club it became. So it's almost like a metamorphosis, that, you know, the chrysalis, and then it bursts forth into glowing colours of the club that we're perhaps, ending with the ethics that it's known for today.
And I suppose, you know, with you, Stephen, as well, it's what it does show, and you know, as we progress through this chat, it'll become more and more obvious, but it kind of shows that actually football, you know, football clubs do belong to the people, as much as the modern game is how it is. But ultimately, football clubs do belong to the community, and as such, you know, they can be shaped. You know, football clubs can be shaped in any way they want if it is done with enough belief and conviction.
Yeah, you know, the ownership of football clubs, you know, it's a case of being a custodian, and the deeds of the club will fall into many different hands over the course of its history, but the supporters tend to be the guiding force in directing the club, the soul of the club. I support Liverpool because it was handed to me by my father. So, you know, in turn, I hand it down to my kids. And that's how a football club will transcend through generation to generation. So yes, you know, football clubs are very much guided, you know, the conscience and the soul and the very ethos of the club, the aura that surrounds a club. You know, I'm a great believer in that, and no one carries a club more so than the supporters do. And they are the great directors of a football club in that respect. And, you know, many football clubs across certainly Europe have a right-wing leaning, and there's probably far more that have a right-wing leaning than a left-wing leaning, unfortunately. So within that, yes, you know, certain rises in political powers will again dictate how supporters carry a club. But then it also becomes a sense of duty almost for the next set of supporters that come along to carry on those traditions. You don't tend to see a football club swing from, you know, a political leaning from right to left in any kind of dramatic way. You know, these are people who will be drawn to a football club because of their beliefs, and they'll look at a football club and think, that is me, you know, and that is how I define myself. So there'll be many reasons why people are drawn to a football club. You might have supporters that don't have that, you know, ancestral passing down of a football club. You might have some that are drawn to a football club simply out of gravity. And yes, you know, it is the supporters that will deflect the club and how they are perceived and what direction they go into.
It's great, and we'll definitely sort of come on to that as well, like you say, about the growth of the club and how fans identify with it. But I guess, Nacho, you know, it's as we sort of go through, and you know, and as you go through the history of this club, you know, clearly the sort of rise of Nazism, you know, can't be ignored. And I suppose really just a little bit about the club's relationship, between the party and the club itself at that time.
Well, probably that's one of the most interesting matters for many people. I mean, how was the behavior of the club during these days? But in the Third Reich, the club acted in compliance with the guidelines issues by the Nazi authorities in sport, in social and in political matters. I mean, I think that we cannot forget that Hamburg was a city controlled by Nazism. So in that sense, and for example, in relation to the Aryan clause implemented by the regime, that clause forced the expulsion of Jews from the administration or the university or associations or sports institutions. So at the first days of Nazism, St. Pauli continued to admit members with a Jewish origin. But it was not so much a challenge against the regime as a simply not following the other issues. But however, in 1940, the club finally includes these Aryan clauses in its statutes. And from that day, for example, the club was aligned with the Nazi propaganda, which was focused, for example, in the nearest Second World War. So I think that it's significant to know that probably the club's position was more something about unconsciousness than a disobedience or defiance when they previously not accept that Aryan clause, because in fact only one member of the board at that time was linked to the Nazi party, and the whole club, I mean the entity, had not shown any militaristic or nationalist vocation at that days. I mean they followed the starting soul of the club, no, kind of a middle class, not identified with the third regime, but not identified as well with working class or anti-fascist movement that was growing up as an opposition against Nazis at that time. So the club has no significance against the Third Reich. The club followed the directions that were issued by the authorities by Nazi authorities, and as we can see, the club was as the other clubs in Germany. So at that days, the club hadn't shown the image or the futures that later on arrived.
Yeah, can I just ask Nacho as well? Do you think, in your opinion, that obviously what happened in that time period did help to sort of almost formulate the direction that the club went in, the club went to? Do you think it had such an impact that the club made not a definite decision, but sort of found its way based on what happened in that period of history?
I don't think so. I don't think that. What happened in that days has a strong relation and a strong effect for all over Germany. But I don't think that that point marked or can define what in the club, what St. Pauli grew up years later. I mean, I think that it is more connected or more related with another social values that came in Europe in connection with 1968 May, more than kind of an opposition of Nazi regime. I mean, the opposition or the fight against fascism, against Nazism, I think it's something that it's inside lots of people in Germany, but I think that it's not one of the matters that based or where we can base the physiognomy of Sampaoli right now, because, for example, there's no other club that is defining itself as a club against any form of discrimination. As we were talking about, you can find many clubs with stands or with terraces, very political, anti-fascist terraces, anti-fascist stands, terraces that are fighting against racism. But you cannot find any club which define itself as an anti-fascist club. So I think that the consequence is not based on the Nazi regime, on the Third Reich. I think it's more connected with another social values or another type of activism that grew in Germany in 70s or in 80s.
Thank you. It was a question that I was interested in. Gary, you know, again, I know I keep coming back to the sort of series that we've done, but, you know, we've seen, you know, be it through countries, national teams, players, clubs, you know, we've seen the sort of the influence that sporting clubs or sporting teams and their use, their propaganda use for political gain or to promote a political message. And I suppose, you know, at this particular period of European, you know, of European history, sporting clubs were so, well, almost like pawns in the wider political picture, weren't they?
Yeah, I guess so. It's really interesting to hear what Nacho has said there, because, you know, the political awareness movements of the sort of late 60s, 70s, you know, had a effect on European, a massive effect on European society. But it didn't have such a massive effect on so many football clubs, certainly not to the extent that he's had on St. Pauli. So I'd be interested, you know, if you, Nacho's thoughts are, is what was there inherent in St. Pauli that made that transition to a sort of an anti-fascist, socialist club more probable than any other club in Germany or in Western Europe at all, I suppose, for that matter. There must have been a sort of the germ of the ethics there that gave birth to the to what Sampaoli became afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a great question, Nacho. You know, where do you think, you know, if it's not necessarily through what happened during the Nazi regime, you know, where do you think that it actually sort of did manifest itself from?
Sorry, mate, go.
No. I think that this is connected with how the Sampaoli became a cult club. And in order to understand how Sampaoli became a cult club, you have to situate what was going on at that time. I mean, I was talking about these relationships because Sampaoli changed at the 80s. So what's going on at that time at the 80s? And we have to base that moment, no, in the late 70s and the 80s to understand the change of the club at that moment. I think that it's necessary to understand the change of the whole area and the whole district. And this is very important because, for example, many people know, or Sampaoli probably is better known as a club that defined itself as an anti-fascist club. But for them, I mean, in Sampaoli, there are some kind of guidelines which are called Die Linien, and that guidelines define the club. And the first of all is that Sampaoli is a club based in the area of Sampaoli. So Sampaoli is one and another association in the area, in the neighborhood. So they have this connection, I mean, and this connection as another NGO or as the church in Sampaoli. So but because of that relationship, because of that connection, it's necessary understand the change of the area or the district that led the club to this futures nowadays. So the 17 were especially a hard time in terms of recession. I mean, I'm talking about oil crisis, coal failures, and unemployment rising. But there were also the germ of social movements. In Germany, Berlin and Hamburg were the center of these social movements, specifically the autonomous movement, the squatter movement, and the ecologies or grief movement. And this atmosphere also coincides with the successive rise of the extreme right, which formed, for example, terraces as a meeting place. So at that moment, I mean that some activists placed in Hamburg went to Millentor at that time called or named Wilhelm Koch Stadium. And at that time is the beginning or the starting point where the club changed. So that's the reason, because I think that the connection or the great connection between any social values or any principles or any point in the history is connected with the change of the club is that. Meaning, is that social values that are defended by some activists who also like football, who went to the stadium, who went to the terraces, and who understood the football as another social activity. So they have to show, or they had to show, their activism, they had to show their political ideas also in the terrace, and they consider the club as another association connected with the area and with the neighborhood. So I think that this is the main issue in that sense.
Can you just jump in for a second, Stu? I mean, just I mean, obviously, this was a situation. I mean, naturally, it's got it really well, but this was all across Western Europe. You know, there was the recession, and there was the sort of political extremism on both sides. But there must have been something fairly unique. It can't be fairly unique. It must be either unique or it's not unique. There must be something unique about St. Pauli that had the conditions to allow that movement to create a club where it didn't happen in other places. It didn't happen to some extent in Paris. It didn't happen to the same extent in Amsterdam. It didn't happen to the same extent in London. So there must have been something unique about St. Pauli. The conditions must have been ripe for that to happen.
Well, I think that one of the conditions is that the club was in regional Liga. So there was so many people in the terrace. I mean, at that time, I think that we were talking about 2,000 people that were following each weekend the club, and I think that the other condition is that you could find a group of people very activist who liked football and who went to the terraces or to the stands at that moment. I mean, there are two necessary conditions. We can talk about a third element that probably is the situation of the club, the situation of the area. I mean, we are talking about a rough area at that time. Rough area, but also a cultural area. I mean, São Paulo was the place where music, culture, and all that stuff grew up or were based. And probably the fourth element is that we found this activist that they used to go to the Volkpark Stadium. I mean, there were a big group that liked football, and they were to they went to Hamburger Stadium as a fans. But at that moment, I mean, we're talking in 80s, they had to face with those extreme right people that are growing up and found terraces as a meeting place. And obviously, people understood football as a hobby, as a space to share experience with their comrades, with their friends. So when they had to leave Ballpark Stadium, when they had to leave the Hamburger Stadium, they finally decided to go to Wilhelm Kopp Stadium, to the stadium of Sampali. I think that these are the conditions. Certainly, they are unique. It's probably the main example or the only one, as we used to say. Sampali is the only one. So probably is the only club that face this kind of condition, and the only club that make these conditions to a great change of the club.
Right, thank you.
Obviously, Stephen, I've got a couple of questions here for you. I mean, one, obviously, you mentioned earlier in sort of England and the UK, it's very much sport must remain, politically neutral, if you like. But do you think there was ever a period of time, and Gary mentioned there that, what whole of Western Europe was like in that sort of late 60s, early 70s and going through. Do you think there was a time where a club could have, maybe not to the same extent as Sampali, but certainly, a club could have taken it on and taken it a step further than it did? Did a club or did even England or UK football miss an opportunity?
It probably did. But I felt like I said before, with certainly from a Liverpool angle, it tends to manifest itself in British sports, as in it will be a section of an existing set of supporters. So, there will be, like we spoke the other week, didn't we, about Liverpool. Supporters not buying into the pay-per-view coverage of the Sheffield United game, I think it was, and instead making a donation to food banks instead, and the raising of like over £100,000 when £10,000 was seen as being kind of like an optimistic target, and then it went all beyond expectations. So, and it's certainly not just a Liverpool thing. It does. I know a lot of clubs will do this, and a lot of clubs do huge amounts within the community, and there'll be sets of supporters at all clubs that will have these pushes to make the world and their communities where their football clubs are better. But, like I say, it tends to be a section of an existing support. When it comes to St. Pauli, the conditions were ripe for kind of a movement to blossom, like Nacho said, on the terraces of this club. The positioning, the geographical positioning of this club, close to the Ypres Barn. It was everything was there for it to give birth to this movement and this collective, and to attract this certain type of supporter that thinks in a certain way. And there just isn't that type of ripe environment in the English game at the minute. I can't think of anywhere that would have sustained something like that, or to have been able to have provoked something like that. Cult clubs are cult clubs for many different reasons. It could be the style of the football that is played, but because political leanings in this country are so lopsided, there is one extreme and the other, and what's in between is just beige. And the in-between that is beige tends to be very safe, and they want to keep out of any kind of arguments. So what you have is two different extremes that wouldn't work together in that type of environment. It's one or the other, and they tend to be small minority, polar opposites of one another. So yes, it's a missed opportunity, but I just don't see a position where it could have happened. It tends to manifest itself in a different way in the UK. it tends to come down to maybe music, or it's a certain area within a city. You know, you Liverpool, you can look at Toxford, you know, Liverpool 8, there is a thriving, you know, bohemian community of so many different ethnicities, and it is a wonderful, wonderful place. And you can look at Brixton in London, and how that has you know, these rebirths in the UK tend to be out of deprived areas of cities that drag themselves up and say, no, we're worth more than this. So, you know, these movements are there. They just don't tend to translate themselves into football grounds.
I get exactly what you're saying. Certainly with regards to the football and how it's perceived in this country. But I just want to ask you a quick question, Nacho, and that's this this phrase, this term of cult club. And I suppose if you just explain a little bit more, you know, Stephen's mentioned there, you know, where the term cult, you know, what it's actually applied to, but certainly, you know, as it's applied in Germany and as it's applied to this club, what, you know, you just explain a little bit about that particular phrase.
I think that phrase, I mean, when we talk about São Paulo as a cult club, we are referring about all that stuff, all that conditions, and all that things that happened in the 70s or in the 80s and 90s, in order to grow a club as we know nowadays. But I think that when we define a cult club, we are defining something more than just a team, something more than football. We are talking about any other conditions, any other stuff, any other elements that makes that club more than a football club. And I mean, for example, we can say or we can explain some of that conditions. I mean that, for example, it's important to point out that the club, for example, was not directly involved in each change. I mean, when we talk about that changes were taking place in the 80s, the club was not directly involved. It adopted most of the concerns reluctantly. I mean, pushed by fans. We have to consider that at that time, for example, the management board didn't want a club with this future. So one of the most important things that São Paulo explained to us, and one of the conditions and one of the elements that can define the São Paulo as a cult club is, for example, how people, how organized fans, how terraces, how stands are able to change the club itself, and how they are able to make a different club. I mean, even if the board doesn't want, and for that reason, I think that for me the most remarkable success at that time, I'm talking about 80s and 90s, related to the fans and the success that allowed us to define São Paulo as a cool club is the Viva São Paulo Festival. I mean, Viva São Paulo Festival was a festival that took part in 1991 and was the explosion of São Paulo as a cult club. It was a festival organized by the social movements at that time to face payment of fines and expenses of lawyer of the autonomous movement and the squatter movement. So although the club didn't want to give any facilities to those people, they finally agreed, and the club left the stadium for them, for that movement, obviously the previous contracting and insurance. And the festival was an impressive success. I mean, punk rock bands came from all over Europe, people from all over Germany went, and many people met São Paulo there. For example, as an anecdote that how they create this kind of club is that the autonomous movement raised more money than was needed. And some of the organizers explained to us, to Carlos and me, how those punks decide, for example, to buy a van from the Protestant church in the neighborhood. And the reason is because that Protestant church were the only ones who cared about kids. So it must have been very funny to see some punks knocking on the door of the church and leave the priest and find these strange people with a gift from him. And that festival probably marked the beginning of the club extension of the club is spread. No, from that moment, I think that many people started to know what São Paulo is and the impact or the incidence of activism in football and how football can be considered as a tool to change things.
It's a great answer. Some of the things you've picked up on there, Gary. I'm going to ask you. Do you think? I suppose we can relate to UK and perhaps certainly for you a little bit in Spain now. You've been there a little while. But do you think that clubs within the UK, it's either a fear of allowing your club to go down this route, or do you also think there's maybe a little bit of jealousy that there is freedom in with clubs like São Paulo who have sort of embraced that freedom and gone and not done it to the extreme, but have gone and allowed their club to develop how they want it to develop? Do you think we look at it, like I say, with a bit of fear and I hope that doesn't happen to our club, or a little bit of jealousy and, oh, I wish that could happen here?
Yeah, good question, Stu. Good question. Good question. I think one of the problems why I can't see a club like, because I can't see an English São Paulo, is so many English clubs are owned by businesses and set out to make money. Football's not the end, it's the means to an end. Their businesses, they're there to make money. And one of the things that struck me about when I read the book is how São Paulo defines success. And they've been promoted to the Bundesliga a couple of times and been relegated. I mean, forgive me, it might be two or three times promoted. But success on the pitch isn't the only type of success. And I don't mean financial success. I mean the success of the club and its honesty and its sincerity. And there's a movement of fans called the, I'm sure Nacho will sort of explain, the social romantics, who have the sort of, the almost like the guardians of the faith, as it were, that, you know, some poorly, you know, they want to see a club win, of course you do, but that's not the only thing. And it's not the only thing because it leads to finance. It's not the only thing because there are more things than winning, there are more things than money. There are more things than sort of getting promotion and winning a cup. There's a sincerity about the club. There's a belief in what your club stands for and what it delivers for the community. It's part of the community. It's part of the society and the autonomous movement that Nacho described.
It's funny you talk about that sort of social romanticism. And I guess, Stephen, do you think that's how... I mean, I don't want to characterise the whole of the British population, the British public, but do you think that that's potentially how it's seen, almost, that São Paulo is this romantic notion, this romantic idea of how a club could operate and could run?
Yes and no. I think it's, rather than seen as a romantic notion, I think it's probably seen as an idealistic one. But idealism can be, you know, used as a fantastic tool to get get stuff done, you know, to make a difference. Making a difference can be, you know, it doesn't always have to be the biggest of things. It can be the smallest of things. You know, it is simply kind of like the gestures, you know, the smallest gestures can make the biggest of differences. And it is, you know, the one kind of one gesture can make a difference, because it can be, if one person does something good and six people say, well, we can do something like that, then that's how these movements grow. And like Nacho said there, you know, about how these punks tip up at the church, and, you know, this is exactly the type of things that do happen in English football. But like I say, they tend to be splinter factions of existing, you know, football clubs. And São Paulo are an existing football club, obviously, but they're an exception in that rule, in how they have evolved to be the club they are and have the following that they do. You know, the fact that there wasn't much more than 1,500 following them in the early 1980s, yet by the, you know, the end of the 1990s, there's about 20,000, and it's become something of a calling almost to become a St. Pauli fan. You know, I'm sure that they support the club because they love the club, but there is more, like Nacho said, it is, you know, behind being a cult club, it is about being more than just a football club. It is a movement. It is a calling. It is, you know, something that's almost divine about it. So yes, these things do happen in English football, but like I say, it tends to be, you know, a splinter faction of football clubs rather than an overall feeling that these clubs permeate. Go on, Gary.
Could I ask Nacho just to sort of, because for listeners who might not be aware, because the Social Romantics are a group of within St. Pauli fans. Just for Nacho to explain who the Social Romantics are and what they represent.
Yeah, I think that Social Romantics, it's expression of belonging to the club. It's an example of the pressure from the terraces. I mean, Social Romantica was a movement born after the 2010 season. I mean, at that moment, for example, was a very commercial moment. At that time, the president was one of the most important businessmen in São Paulo, related all with some businesses connected with local of striptease or kind of that businesses. And at that moment, for example, the club rented one of the reserved areas of the stadium to the Susie Show Bar. Susie Show Bar was a company that owned and stripped this club. And a pole dancing bars were installed to entertain the guests in these reserved areas during the matches. As well as that decision, for example, the club chose Kalte Muschi as the official drink of the club. I mean, Muschi in German is similar to Kunt in English. And obviously both decisions were seen by the terraces, by fans, and as an example of women discrimination. On the other hand, at that season, for example, the management board decided to install giant screens in the stadium, in the pitch, so that fans could send SMS during the matches, and they could be read. That messages they could be read during the match. So against this kind of decision, the movement of the Social Romantiker was created among the fans, and they demand, for example, not to include advertising during the moments before starting the match. They demanded cancel the contract with Susie Show Bar, not to install screens, not put ads during the matches, not selling the name from the stadium to any company. They want to change the VIP seats into seats at popular prices, and they want do not do any business with sponsors suspected of racism, fascism, or homophobia. Social Romanticers, for example, identified themselves with a black school on a red background, and their slogan was "Bring back São Paulo." So that movement was an incredibly success. I mean, the whole stadium supported the idea. The whole stadium were waving this black skull, black school on the red background, were shouting the slogan that bring back São Paulo. And finally, the movement achieved that the club had a meeting with fan clubs in order to negotiate any matters. I mean, especially those who were connected with commercial activities. And for example, as a result, the contract with Susie Show Bar was cancelled. So I think that Social Romantica, that movement showed that people had the power. I mean, that organized fans could change the path of the club. The club was, the direction of the club at that moment was very bad. And that fans could change that direction and could put on the first term, once again, their social values. I mean, we are a club against any type of discrimination, so we had to cancel this contract with Sushi Sobar, with Kalte Muski, and with any company who is suspect of any women discrimination. So if we are a club that we are defending our roots, that we are defending our neighborhood, so we have to connect with that. And I think that this social romantic shows us, show that power, how people can, how fans, how terraces can organize and can change the direction of the club.
This is why the book is so fascinating and why San Paolo is such a fascinating club. And even then, you know, as Nacho was talking, this sort of idealism of sort of, you know, retaining identity, retaining ethics, retaining, you know, the core values of the club over the commercial potential of the club, of which there, you know, now there is probably, you know, increased opportunities based on the sort of global fame. You know, the commercial opportunities must be there, but ultimately it's club first, it's identity first, it's belief, it's values. And again, I suppose, you know, this isn't meant to be a podcast that sort of contrasts between the British game and the German game. It's just, you know, as a frame of reference, it's so at odds with what's going on in the Premier League at the moment.
Exactly, buddy. And this is one of the reasons I wanted Nacho to explain the social romantic movement, because he can do far better than I could. And there's nothing like that in English football, because it's so dominated by money. Even if you go far down the leagues, I mean, if you go to grassroots football in sixth or seventh tier of the pyramid, you're in something different. But generally, you know. And this is why I said earlier about, you know, there's different ways of defining success. And the social romantic movement at St. Pauli, as I say, they're almost like the guardian of the ethics of the club. That's his success. The success on the pitch is okay. The success off the pitch is just as important. And, you know, we're into this sort of situation now where, because of the success, because of the renown, because of the fame of St. Pauli, there's going to be even more pressure on the club to, I hate to use a phrase, but, you know, forgive me, cash in on that fame. And I just hope the social romantic movement is strong enough to keep that at bay, because commercialism versus identity is going to be a major factor for the club because of its growing fame.
It's a great point. I was just about to ask Stephen that as well there. Do you think that sort of it could almost act as a, this increased commercial opportunity can actually strengthen the resolve of the club, Stephen, in, you know, to retain its identity and to retain its, like we said, this status that it holds, this, you know, these values that it puts before everything. You know, this increased commercial opportunity could almost act as a, you know, to almost reinforce what it is that the club believes. You know, it could act as an opportunity to make an even bigger statement, you know, on an even wider scale, if that's possible, with regards to really reinforcing that it actually is club first, or, you know, commercialism second.
Yes, you know, it needs clubs like St. Pauli to take a stand in these circumstances. Rayo Vallecano, you know, similar in the way that, you know, in a different manner, but the way that they protested about Monday night football matches and stuff like that, it is often the easy route to just accept, you know, negative kind of changes and commercialism and all of that, higher ticket prices. There's all sorts of things to rebel against in football, as football fans, match going football fans, you know, are the ones that can take the stand the most, because they are the ones, you know, in normal times that are there on the terraces and can be heard and seen. In taking a stand against over commercialisation of football, of being that moral compass. So you know, it's a big yes for me. You know, so we've discussed it here for the best part of an hour, is that supporters can really make a difference if they are, you know, organised and in agreement with each other, and, you know, to be able to put that point across in a reasoned manner. And that's always one of the big secrets behind it. Not a secret, but, you know, it is the fact that you've got to be, you know, well measured and reasoned in your arguments, and to pick your arguments well, and to have them well beaten in reasoned arguments. And collectives can do this in a way that, you know, smaller collectives can't, or, you know, a collective railing against an individual, you know, can, you know, one powerful individual against a collective of small people that feel strongly enough about something can make a massive, massive difference. And within that, you know, football is a massive, huge, you know, vehicle to be able to do that. But it's being able to draw it all together, and to have a club like St. Pauli, such a unique club as St. Pauli, to be able to do that as often as they do as well. It's an incredible thing.
It is. And it, like I say, we, you know, as Steve mentioned there, you know, we're already sort of over the hour, but there's a couple more things, Nacho, that I would like to ask you. And the first one being, with regards to the book, you know, have the club, you know, are the club pleased with the book as a representation of their, you know, of what it is that they do? Have they, you know, have they been in touch? Do they, you know, are they happy with how the club is being represented?
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
In terms of obviously the research that goes into it, you know, were people happy to, you know, to talk to you about, you know, so you could get a real feel for the club, or was it done more from as a sort of a social observer?
No, our position is. I mean, our position when we write a book is both. We are real observer. I think that you are asking me about our position. Is that right?
Well, it's more how the club have perceived how you have brought the club to the attention to a wider audience through your book.
Oh, the club. Well, yes. the club make any facilities for us to write a book. I mean, we had contact with some people around the club to make any facility to us in order to write a book. I think that for us, the most incredible thing is meeting those people who in 80s and 90s changed the club. The most incredible thing was meeting Volker, meeting those punks, and that explained to us how they built the club, how they imagine the club, and how they fight to a football club as an association link with the area and with the neighborhood. From the club, as I told you before, we got any facilities. For example, we got any facilities from people who are working in the museum. They show to us any photos. They explain to us anything that we need in order to understand the previous history, you know, the history of before the 70s and the 80s. But the club was really great with us.
That's great. And I think Gary, that's that comes with, you know, as Nacho's described, that sort of willingness to share, that sort of comes from a pride in what it is that your club is, what a club stands for. You know, some clubs certainly, again, can be so notoriously difficult to get to because they always assume there's an ulterior motive, where here you have a club that is incredibly proud of what it does and almost throws its doors open so that, you know, what they do can be seen as wide as possible.
Yeah, you almost couldn't imagine them not being helpful.
No, exactly, yes, exactly.
So off centre. I just hope something like word. I mean, you really sort of want to be convinced that the future's not going to destroy the ethos of St. Pauli. You know, their success is almost a danger to them because the opportunities for commercial exploitation of their fame is enormous. And you just sort of hope that that's, you know, the red and black skull and crossbones keep flying for a long time at St. Pauli.
And that's it, isn't it, Steve? You know, this danger. And I will ask Nacho in a second about, you know, his thoughts on the future of the club. But I guess, you know, Stephen, like we say, it's not that it's a precarious time, but it's, like we say, that exploitation, it's, you know, in the world we currently live in sort of 2020, it's that potential for exploitation is always, always there.
Oh, it's massive. You know, you only have to look at, say, you know, Athletic Club in Spain, in La Liga. You know, they have their own set of rules to run the club by, but over a period of years, certain scriptures have been eroded a little bit. The rules have been bent, you know, as far as possible sometimes, but you know, still they maintain this sense of duty to these rules that they've set down over the years. And St. Pauli, I think, are in a position where they're less likely to be in a corruptible state. If you're looking at the broader spectrum of the German game, if you think about where they might want to get to, so if they were to be corruptible in a commercial state, yes, they could go into the top flight Bundesliga and have, you know, a longer, more prosperous time. And in a way, you know, Union Berlin will be the perfect microcosm of that, you know, and how they do over the coming years. But I think there's enough about St. Pauli to maintain the discipline in this respect, because there's a set of supporters there that will forever, you know, they will forever bring that sense of accountability to those who are in charge of the club. You know, it's really, you know, great when a set of supporters will stand up to their own club when they feel like they've turned down, you know, a wrong alley or the moving in a way that does not sit with the ethos of a football club. I've seen it with my own club, and fans will stand as one and say, this isn't right. And, you know, and they will, you know, achieve success in getting the club to climb down from positions of controversy somewhat. So I St. Pauli, I'm confident, have got more than enough about them and a set of supporters that have the ideals that they do to keep the club, you know, along the lines of what they do now. I don't see a great deal of change there. I don't see them fall into temptation.
I guess then, Nacho, that sort of the last question to put to you is, can you put us all at ease and sort of how do you see the future of St. Pauli as a club? You know, does it have the capability to stick to its philosophies, stick to its principles, you know, and sort of resist what will be, I'm assuming, an ever growing pressure to maybe change or to, you know, like you say, to accept commercialism into its, you know, into its club? You know, can it resist all the pressures that are going to come its way in the future?
Well, I totally agree with Gary. I think that the biggest challenge right now for St. Pauli is this fight between commercialism and identity. I mean, if identity can be lost because of an over-exploitation of the mark, of the San Paoli mark. Right now, for example, you can find two different options or two different opinions in the terraces. You can find people who are right now defending that they are a professional football club. So as they are a professional football club, I mean, they have to win. So they don't have to lose their values, their principles, but they have to do things in order to get incomes to, for example, buy good football players, trying to promote to Bundesliga. But you can find another very big group of people that are defending that the social values is the first. So we have to stop this over-exploitation. We have to stop this great commercialism in order to keep the principles, in order to keep the social values, because the most important is that point. So I think that right now you can find this kind of fight in the club, and probably the key, probably the person who can link the two opinions or the two options is right now Åke Gottlieb, the president, because obviously he's the president. Obviously, he's the most important person in the management board. Obviously, he has to work in order to succeed, in order to promote to the Bundesliga, in order to win matches, in order to succeed on the pitch. But he came from the Südkurve. He came from the terraces. So he, I think that he understands what people are thinking and what people think about their social values and about their principles. So I really think that this is the big risk for the club in the future. The risk that that San Paoli can become only a mark, can become only a symbol, but the risk is that San Paoli lose their principles and lose their connection with people, and this risk is also not only in the club. This risk is also in the area, is also in the neighborhood. I mean, we talked before that San Paoli area, that the neighborhood changed from the beginning of the 20th century to nowadays. But right now, San Paoli area is also changing. I mean, there is a big gentrification of the area that implies that many people are leaving San Paoli. Many neighbors are leaving San Paoli, are forced to leave San Paoli. So this is quite of a challenge that have to face the club on one hand, but the area on the other hand, to keep the connection with people, to keep their social values, and to keep kind of an activist movement in club or in the area.
Wow. Gary, there, as a closing comment from Nacho, how does that make you feel?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's exactly what you want to hear, really, you know, except that, you know, it's a little bit sort of concerning that, you know, the gentrification of these sort of things tends to be a recurring theme. For anybody who wants to know a little bit more or a lot more about San Paoli as I did, I wanted to know, this book's fantastic. It's life affirming. It shows that, you know, football ain't just the commercialism, the rampant money grabbing Premier League that we all sort of know and tolerate. It gives you hope. It gives you a little bit of belief that, you know, football is a game for the people, and you know, you want to believe, you want to hope, and you want to be convinced that San Paoli will survive in the way they have been up the past. You know, and all I can say is just help the social romantics still control that club, because it would be a terrible loss, not only to football, but to society and you know, to the world if San Paoli if St. Pauli became just another football club. That would be a tragedy.
Yeah, and I think Stephen, there, I think while sort of St. Pauli exists in its current guise, whether clubs want to do it or not, whether all fans around the world appreciate it or not, but while they exist, it's possible. Do you get what I'm saying?
Completely. You know, they're there as an example of what can be done.
Yeah.
You know, as people are drawn together, you know, what you can achieve if you so wish. And they are, you know, a great example to the rest of football's community.
Like I say, you know, Nacho, it's, you know, the book, San Paoli, Another Football Is Possible. It is, you know, and as Gary said, it's such a great read. It's life affirming. It, you know, it gives you belief back into the game of football and the good that football can do. And it's not just about the sport. Like you say, it's about the people. It's about the community. It's about its geographical location. It's about its history. It's about all of these things. However, you know, what your book does is life-affirming. It does sort of give hope and faith as to what football can do. And as Stephen's mentioned there, you know, what a group of people can do as well. Thank you ever so much, much for joining us and chatting about what is a wonderful, wonderful book and a wonderful football club.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for this time. As Che Guevara said that we want 1 to 1,000 of Vietnams, we say that we want 1 to 1,000 of São Paulis.
that's it. There you go, Gary. You like that?
That's good to me, mate.
Stephen, you know, thank you as always for sort of joining us on the podcast. Enjoyed it?
Oh, immensely. You know, Nacho's been a great guest, talking about such a brilliant topic and a wonderful, wonderful book. Do go out and buy it, please.
And obviously for you, Gary, like we said at the start, you know, as Stephen said there, wonderful book, but, you know, we said at the beginning this was sort of going to be in your sweet spot, and an hour and 20 minutes later, I guess, it's an hour and 20 minutes of stuff that you enjoy listening to and talking about.
Definitely, mate. And somewhere there's a bloke on a hill standing alone, waving the black and red skull and crossbones of St. Pauli, and I'll salute that guy and long may wave that flag.
Brilliant. I hope he's listening to this as well at some point. all that's left for me to say is thank you for listening, and please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Town. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.